Order.
The harsh reality of being a minority government in a parliament ruled by its majority was exposed again this week as John Key's National-led administration scrambled to secure the 61 votes needed to pass legislation in this 121-seat House of Representatives. Once again, the House split right down the middle, this time over a Labour amendment to the government's Health and Safety Reform Bill. That amendment defeated by the slimmest of margins, 61-60, as the highly complex and controversial bill crawled its way through the stage where the House forms itself into a committee and legislation is debated part by part and is subject to amendment. Introduced back in March last year, the bill replaces the Health and Safety and Employment Act of 1992 and the even older Machinery Act of 1950, when, in a simpler world, there were workers and bosses, who are now to become persons conducting a business or undertaking, or PCBU, while workers are defined as somebody who carries out work in any capacity for a PCBU, that taking in employees, contractors, trainees, those gaining work experience and volunteers. That's in the bill itself in six parts covering some 270 pages, which is accompanied by a government amendment or supplementary order paper or SOP, which is almost as big and contains the mechanism for classifying the degree of risk in various enterprises. Although the bill had been available since late last month, when it was reported back from the Transport and Industrial Relations Select Committee for its second reading, the controversial amendments classifying risk had still not been finalised on Tuesday, with relatives of some of the 29 men killed in the Pike River coal mine disaster in the public gallery waiting for the bill to enter its next stage. The debate actually began on Tuesday with this question for the Prime Minister, John Key, from the Leader of the Opposition, Andrew Little.
Given that since the 29 deaths at Pike River, around 290 more New Zealanders have died at work, despite his promise of better laws, does he seriously think he has done enough to protect Kiwis at work?
The Speaker, Honourable Prime Minister. I think the member is deliberately misleading the House. The correct number is 233.
In the time it takes for a researcher to get onto Google and text the answer back to the Chamber, the Opposition Leader came back with this.
Point of order, Andrew Little.
Mr Speaker, I seek leave to table a report from WorkSafe New Zealand confirming that since 2010 there have been a total of 299 workplace deaths in New Zealand.
Order, leave us sought to table that particular document. Is there any objection? There is none. It can be tabled.
Up in the beehive, the Prime Minister's staff had also been on the Google.
Point of order, the Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I seek leave to table a WorkSafe New Zealand report that shows quite clearly that since the Pike River mine, there have been 233 fatalities.
Leave us thought to table that particular document. Is there any objection? There is none. It can be tabled.
So with two documents on the table, both from the same source, WorkSafe New Zealand, one reporting 233 deaths and the other 299, Mr Little put this question to the Prime Minister.
In light of the presence in around Parliament today of some of the families of Pike River victims, is the real reason for the delay in the passage of the Health and Safety Reform Bill because of internal divisions in the National Party and difficulties with support parties?
Mr Speaker, no, there's a genuine desire and also a need to work with our support partners to actually get the legislation correct.
Andrew Little then asked Mr Key the $64 million question about whether farming would be classified as a high-risk business in the legislation.
Does he stand by his statement that, quotes, there have been too many deaths on farm for there not to be changes, end quotes, and if so, will he guarantee that agriculture will be included as a high-risk industry under the Health and Safety Reform Bill?
Mr Speaker, I stand by my statement. No, I wouldn't guarantee that agriculture with employees of 20 or less would be deemed high risk. What the government will do is take the best advice, and the Minister will be introducing that tomorrow.
The Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety is Michael Woodhouse, and he duly kicked off the Health and Safety Reform Bill's committee stage after Wednesday's general debate with these thoughts.
We can pass all the laws, rules and regulations we like. What will make the fundamental change, and is making the fundamental change, to keeping people healthy and safe at work is a change in behaviour and attitude. And that behoves us all to do that and to work across business, across workers, across directors and across everybody to ensure that we achieve that.
Then, as promised by his Prime Minister, Mr Woodhouse tabled the SOP containing the risk classifications, drawing this immediate response from Phil Twyford, one of Labor's members on the select committee that had considered the bill.
It has been substantially weakened by the carve-out in the bill that effectively exempts firms with fewer than 30 employees from the requirement to allow the appointment or election of health and safety representatives when requested. It is going to carve out from the provisions in this bill more than 300,000 New Zealand employees, or a quarter of the workforce, perhaps.
Phil Twyford's Labour colleague Sue Moroney said the bill had been with the committee for 5 or 6 weeks.
And went nowhere, and did nothing. And today we find this document, this is the SOP put forward by the Minister, with a range of amendments and changes that the Select Committee could have been considering while it sat idle for 5 or 6 weeks, while the National Party sorted out its internal politics.
Among questions that might have been better sorted out in the committee rooms was this one.
What makes a worm farm more dangerous than a cattle farm?
The Minister cautioned Sue Moroney against making light of deaths and injuries in farming activities classified under miscellaneous.
In the category of other livestock farming, of which worm farming is one, there were 11 people killed at work and more than 1,000 serious injuries. Now, well, the member asked how many were killed on dairy farms. We could stratify this any way we like. We could say some forestry is in but other forestry is out. Some livestock farming is in but other livestock farming is out.
But Sue Moroney wasn't going to stop at worm farms.
Why is mini golf more dangerous than actual golf? Why is putting up curtains in a building more dangerous than demolishing a building? Why is driving a bus full of tourists more dangerous than driving a bus full of schoolchildren?
The Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
The fact that an organisation may not be required to have a health and safety rep does not let them off the hook. All PCBUs, all workers, will be required to participate in health and safety at work.
The Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, Michael Woodhouse, still in the chamber, sitting beside the committee chairman, as the debate on his health and safety reform bill dragged on towards Thursday's adjournment at 6, fulfilling this prediction from Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard at the very start.
It is my expectation that this will be one of the more contentious debates and I think it's generally agreed one of the longer debates that we're likely to have in this Parliament.
Just how long won't be known until next week, when the debate enters its 8th hour on Tuesday for the completion of the 3 remaining parts and the 6 schedules. More work for Michael Woodhouse, while his Cabinet colleague Murray McCully was the subject of this question on Tuesday for the Prime Minister from Greens co-leader James Shaw.
Will he stand down, the Honourable Murray McCully, as Minister of Foreign Affairs, while the Auditor-General investigates the Saudi Arabia Food Security Partnership? If not, why not?
Right, Honourable Speaker. Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, no, because I do not believe it would be appropriate to do so in the circumstances.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Given that the Auditor-General had, quote, insufficient information about the legality, end quote, of the Saudi deal, how can the Prime Minister continue to have confidence in a minister that pushed the deal through anyway?
Speaker,
the Right Honourable Prime Minister.
I'm not going to go through all the merits of it because it's now before the Auditor-General, but I think the member's actually referring to a statement made quite early on in the piece. There was a lot that happened after that. But I'm advised that the officials confirmed that the transaction was lawful and within the scope of the Ministry's appropriation.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
To the Prime Minister, does he have concerns about Murray McCully's involvement in the Saudi sheep deal, given that Murray McCully has previously been caught making, quote, unlawful payments, end quote, to members of the Tourism Board?
Are they right, Honourable Prime Minister?
Mr Speaker, no.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
To the Prime Minister. Given that Judith Collins resigned prior to an inquiry being launched on the basis of one email, why has the Prime Minister not called for Murray McCully's resignation, given that there is now an investigation into his actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, well, I'd note that Ms Collins resigned. but I'm also advised that the officials confirmed that the transaction was lawful within the scope of the Ministry's appropriation in the purview of Cabinet, and I'm quite happy with the transaction.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given that Phil Heatley resigned over a $70 expense claim, why has the Prime Minister not asked Murray McCulley to resign for making a $4 million payment of questionable legality?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm pretty sure what the Auditor General will find is it's not of questionable legality, it's lawful.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister. Given that ministers have gone down over emails and $70 expense claims, does his propping up of Murray McCulley show that his own standards are slipping?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no. And, Mr. Speaker, I'm quite comfortable, actually, that the transaction will bear the scrutiny of the Auditor General. It was done within the purview of officials. It was done lawfully within the authority that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and others had. It was signed off by Cabinet. And, Mr. Speaker, I'm very comfortable with the process.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Why should Kiwis be represented on the world stage by a minister who is under investigation for yet another possibly unlawful payment?
Mr. Speaker.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
The Minister's not under investigation. No, he's not. The Minister is not under investigation. He has my 100% confidence.
Question number three. Andrew Little.
The opposition leader said his question had originally been set down for answer by the Prime Minister, but the government had transferred it to Associate Finance Minister Paula Bennett. Mr. Little's request for it to be transferred back to the Prime Minister was rejected by the Speaker, David Carter.
No, I refer the member to Speaker's ruling 1695. I'm not prepared to put the leave. It is a prerogative of the government to decide where the leave has gone, where the question's gone to. They've made that decision. The member wants to continue asking it. As it's on the order paper, he can do so.
The opposition leader's case was taken up by his chief whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I anticipated that this was going to arise because of the transfer of the question and went back and reviewed all of the Hansard from the last term of Parliament where the then Leader of the Opposition, John Key, was putting down questions to the then Prime Minister, Helen Clark, and could find no examples where the Prime Minister transferred a question from the Leader of the Opposition. And therefore, I ask that the House give consideration to whether that ruling that you referred to should actually apply in this circumstance, because there has to be an ability for the opposition to question the Prime Minister on a range of issues. The Prime Minister ultimately is responsible for all issues around the government's policy and progress.
I'll hear from the Honourable Gerry Brownley.
The government's leader of the House sought to counter his opposition shadow's argument.
Well, Mr. Speaker, quite apart from the fact that the appropriate delegation does lie with the minister who is going to answer the question today, referring to the previous government's arrangement simply points to the fact that when it came to Helen Clark, she was head and shoulders in competence above anybody else in that government.
Order. 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 The last comment. Order. Order. I'm on my feet for the benefit of all members. The last comment from the Leader of the House was unhelpful to the Order of the House. But in regards to the point, order. Order. In regards to the point raised by Chris Hipkins, there are plenty of opportunities for the Leader of the Opposition to ask questions of the Prime Minister, and that's been used on a very regular basis through most question times. When I look at the wording of this particular question, it is very much about the workings of the Overseas Investment Office, and therefore I see no difficulty at all with the fact that it's been transferred. I don't think in any way it will lessen the quality of the answer. The answer, therefore, lies in the future if the member, the Leader of the Opposition, wants to target a question to the Prime Minister, then he needs to change the wording and, in this case, not refer so much to the portfolio of Overseas Investment Office.
The Speaker's ruling drew fresh argument from Chris Hipkins.
The tension that the Opposition finds between asking general primary questions and more specific primary questions. What we are endeavouring to do in most of our questions now rather than asking the does he stand by all of his statements, actually be more specific in giving an indication of the direction of travel of the supplementary questions. The risk of doing that now under this arrangement is that, in fact, the Prime Minister could answer next to no questions, because as soon as we give an indication of the nature of the question, he therefore has grounds to transfer them.
Despite Mr Carter saying he had heard enough, Gerry Brownlee still wanted to make a further argument.
I think the point is that while the shallowly you might say that the Labor Party are asking questions that require a high degree of specificity in order that they get good information, it's equally the government's desire that they do get good information. Therefore, the question is transferred to the minister, who is likely to have far more at her fingertips than the general information that might come in preparation for those closed-off questions.
Mr Carter invited members to look at the relevant speaker's rulings on pages 168 to 169 in the current edition.
It has been long held a convention that the government has the right to decide where the question will be directed. The only involvement for me as Speaker would be to intervene in that process if I saw it as a deliberate attempt by a government not to be accountable for the question that's being asked. In this case, I do not see that at all.
But Labor's Grant Robertson had also been looking at Speaker's rulings.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Grant Robertson, fresh point of order.
I want to refer you to Speaker's ruling 1682.
Sorry?
Speaker's ruling 1682 from Speaker Smith, where it does state, as you say, that the government is entitled to transfer questions. However, it does say that the Speaker would be concerned if this was anathema to the obtaining of information and if the Minister or Prime Minister being questioned could be the only person who had particular information. The first leg of this question is about a statement made by the Prime Minister. We simply cannot see how any other minister can have that information. And I think this is a clear case where Standing Order 168, Speaker's Ruling 1682 comes into play. And how can the minister stand by the Prime Minister's statement?
I disagree entirely with the member. And furthermore, when he said he was raising a fresh point of order, he's taken the opportunity to simply relitigate a decision I've made. If the Leader of the Opposition wants to proceed with the question, he can do so. If he does not want to proceed with the question, then we'll move immediately to question number four. It's in the hands of the Leader of the Opposition.
Andrew Little signalled that he would not be asking the question, reducing Wednesday's daily dozen questions for oral answer by ministers to 11. Next day, though, questions included several from the Greens Transport spokeswoman, Julianne Genta, about the government's 30-year infrastructure plan published that day. Although she'd addressed her questions to the Minister of Finance, Bill English, they were answered for him by his Cabinet colleague, Stephen Joyce.
Does the 30-year New Zealand Infrastructure Plan identify reduction of greenhouse gas pollution and adaptation to climate change as key challenges for infrastructure planning over the next 30 years? And if not, why not?
Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, yes.
Supplementary question, Julianne Genta.
Why is climate change not mentioned even once in the action plan on page 51 of the 30-year infrastructure report?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, actually, I'm not sure that the member's completely correct, although I would have to refer, because actually there is some references in a number of places in the report in regards to climate change.
Supplementary question, Julianne Genta.
What specific projects in the National Infrastructure Plan will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and what percentage of the overall spend on infrastructure do they make up?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I don't have that to hand, and I'm not sure that would be a practical way of presenting an infrastructure plan. The reality is all infrastructure has to take into account climate change. So, for example, if you're expecting sea level rise and you're building a bridge on a coastal environment, you'll probably build it a little higher than you would have perhaps in the past, and we see that a number of times in a number of infrastructure projects.
Supplementary question, Julianne Genta.
Does he see the incoherence in an infrastructure plan that mentions climate in passing but devotes over 80% of transport spending to projects that will increase carbon emissions rather than decrease them?
Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I just don't agree with the member's characterisation of transport projects, and this may come to a quite fundamental difference between the government and the Green Party on this matter, because the government doesn't believe that people will sacrifice their personal mobility over the next 50 years in response to climate change. We believe that actually they will change the fuel mix of their vehicles in response to climate change, but there'll still be cars and there'll probably still be buses and they will need roads, and that's the bulk of the transport projects the member refers to.
What is the Minister's response to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, which calls on governments to prioritise infrastructure that reduces greenhouse pollution as the best way to achieve stronger economic performance, and amongst that infrastructure to prioritise public transport in urban areas?
Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I might have some awareness of exactly how much we've already done that, which is huge, actually. This government has arrived at a point and invested alongside local government to ensure that we have brand new electric commuter trains in both of our major cities, Auckland and Wellington. That has happened under this government, Mr Speaker. This government has also invested hugely in public transport more generally.
Supplementary question, Julie Ann Genter.
Apart from electrification of the rail network, which was promised by a previous government, are there any new major projects in the 30-year plan that will reduce emissions and enable New Zealand families and households and businesses to go about their daily lives without increasing carbon emissions? What are they, Minister?
Well, Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I firstly must need to correct the member's incorrect version of the electrification in Auckland. It may have been wishlisted by a previous government, but it was funded and appropriated by this government in the face of the global financial crisis. And she can pretend that's not the case because it doesn't fit her narrative, but it isn't true. And in terms of the future, Mr Speaker, we will continue to invest in public transport.
Is the Minister and the rest of the Cabinet living on another planet where somehow climate change is not going to affect infrastructure or change the way that people get around? Or will they join us in the real world where global business leaders are calling on governments to prioritise climate change, pollution reduction in their infrastructure planning?
Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, it's never a good idea to write your last supplementary question before you come down to the House. Mr Speaker, because I've shown through all the answers that that is completely different. And here's the plan, Mr Speaker, and here's page 7 for the member with the reference to climate change. Here's a later page, page 47. Here's another page here, page 33. Here's another page here, page 69. Here's another page, page 80. If the member would like me to get my stickers out and highlight it for her and deliver it to her office, I'm more than happy to do so.
And another milestone this week is Mr Key's Finance Minister, Bill English, put his seventh budget to bed with the passing on Tuesday of the Appropriation 2015-16 Estimates Bill through its third and final reading. Now from the storms and squalls of the debating chamber to the calmer waters of the committee rooms with Rhys Lyon.
Pollution of rivers by the government-owned farming company LandCorp was the subject of a petition calling for a moratorium on conversions of LandCorp properties to dairy farms. The petition is in the name of Green MP Catherine Delahunty, who presented it to the Primary Production Committee on Thursday.
There's a great public interest in this issue, a great passion for clean water for all reasons. And when Mahi Drysdale gets up and says, my lake, which is an iconic rowing lake, has turned pink and is sick, I think that we're at huge international reputational risk in that area. And farmers downstream who signed my petition were very clear that they're doing their bit downstream. They're trying. And they feel undermined when the government farmer is actually proposing something that will create even more environmental cost to them.
Catherine Delahunty was accompanied in presenting the petition by Massey University Professor of Freshwater Ecology, Russell Death, who outlined the science behind concerns about LandCorp's plans in the Waikato.
LandCorp seem to be planning to add an additional 25 to 27 or 43,000 cows. As I said, each cow produces in the order of about 14 times the waste of an individual human. If you add that up, the sums come to about 350,000 people. So that's a population of 1.5 times of Hamilton. And the thing is about that waste that's not treated. It's going onto the soil and then directly into the waterways. It's going to add somewhere in the order of maybe 1,200 extra tonnes of nitrogen, maybe an extra 300 tonnes from the support land, However, it's going to be adding it into the Waikato River, which is already over-allocated in terms of the amount of nitrates which are in there. Adding those cows, increasing the nitrogen on the land and then into the waterways, will result in the degradation of the river.
Back to Catherine Delahunty, who pointed to another potential problem in Landcorp's plans.
Linda Te Aho, who's the negotiator for Ngāti Koroki Kahukura from Waikato, she said that the conversions are actually against the purpose of their treaty settlement. So I think that's going to be an emerging issue for them as well, that they're seeing the conversions as actually an undermining of the settlement, which, you know, government's put a lot of work into their settlement, so it is quite a serious situation.
Ms. Delahunty urged the committee to look at what could be done to rein in the river pollution.
Because I'm aware that sometimes petitions come before us and we basically just accept them. I'd love to see this committee discuss some more proactive action around Landcorp, because I think it's in the national interest as well as in the interest of the Waikato waterways.
Green MP Catherine Delahunty presenting that petition to the Primary Production Committee. Earlier in the week, on Wednesday, the Social Services Committee heard submissions on the Support for Children in Hardship Bill and heard from UNICEF National Advocacy Manager Deborah Morris-Travers, who pointed to evidence suggesting a $25 increase in benefits wasn't adequate for many beneficiary families.
Most families will need an increase of income of between $100 to $200. So with that in mind, our submission to the Select Committee proposes that you amend the bill so that the bill provides not just $25 a week to each household, but $25 per week for every child. We know that in terms of the larger families where poverty is more prevalent, that actually the $25 a week is wholly inadequate. So we recommend that you increase it to $25 per child.
UNICEF National Advocacy Manager Deborah Morris-Travers. And also making a submission on that aspect of the bill was Wellington Community Justice Project volunteer Ruby King.
We think that while this increase will somewhat alleviate financial strain, it is not an effective long-term solution. We therefore suggest that Parliament, in addition to increasing benefit rates, considers adopting a more comprehensive approach to tackle child poverty. Fundamental issues such as access to education, mental health treatment and proper housing will provide a more long-term solution than simply increasing benefit rates.
Ruby King, who had a busy Wednesday, appearing later in the morning before the Law and Order Committee to make a submission on the electronic monitoring of offenders legislation.
It is our suggestion that electronic monitoring should be paired with other, more intensive forms of community rehabilitation. In Norway, for example, electronic monitoring is paired with heavy focus on individually adjusted supervision, including further measures such as sound knowledge of the offender, tight supervision, mandatory motivational and crime prevention programs, and other such measures, often specific to the offender. This has proven to be of great success. We suggest the Select Committee makes it clear in its report to Parliament that electronic monitoring alone will not serve offenders or New Zealand communities' needs in reintegrating offenders back into the community and keeping our communities safe.
Wellington Community Justice Project volunteer Ruby King. In total, there were 15 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber, some sad news from the Speaker, David Carter, on Tuesday.
Honourable members, I regret to inform the House of the death on 17 August 2015 of the Honourable George Frederick Gere, CMG QSO, who represented the North Shore electorate from 1966 to 1990. From 1972 to 1984, he held a number of portfolios, including Minister of Health, Minister of Social Welfare and Minister of Transport.
And from the current Minister of Transport, Simon Bridges, in his capacity as Deputy Leader of the House, this preview of the week ahead in his business statement on Thursday.
When the House resumes on Tuesday, 25 August, the government will look to continue the Health and Safety Reform Bill and a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday is Members' Day.
With the weekly general debate on Wednesday and question times, that'll leave the government just over 8 hours of chamber time to pass its health and safety reform bill through its remaining stages. More details on our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.